Thanks, Cheryl. Can everyone hear me okay? Yeah, great. And thanks to OutStories and to the Institute for inviting me here to speak at this exciting event. I hope you won't mind that I generally read from my script, because I'd like to try and keep vaguely to time so you can all go and have some refreshments in good time afterwards. So, as Cheryl said, today I'm going to be talking about E.P. Warren, Edward Perry Warren. And he's probably best known today for giving his name to the Warren Cup, which you may know already, an ancient Roman cup or goblet with explicit scenes of men having sex together, which is now in the British Museum, and you can see one of the sides of the Warren Cup here. Born in America, but spending most of his time in the UK, Warren was one of the foremost collectors of classical antiquities at the turn of the 20th century in Europe and America. And among the hundreds of objects that Warren collected, he bought, are many of those which now provide us with visual evidence of homoeroticism and sex between men in the ancient world. And today I want to introduce Warren to you and have a look at some of the artifacts that he collected, and also to think about how he used these artifacts to understand and express his own sexuality and to campaign in his own sort of particular way for the acceptance of same-sex relationships in the modern world. Warren's ideal of relationships was drawn directly from the convention that Ellen's just been talking about, the convention of ancient Greek pederasty, or paiderastia in the ancient Greek. And this was, as Ellen said, a sort of erotic mentorship relationship between an older and a younger man. And Warren really called for the revival of these relationships in the modern day. So what I'd like to think about today as well is the sort of differences between what Warren was doing and what we might think of today in terms of LGBT movements for liberation and acceptance. I'll also be talking about Simmons, you'll be pleased to hear, so I'll try and fit some Simmons in there somewhere. Warren was really inspired by Simmons and Simmons' own Greek-inspired idea of very sort of virile, comradely relationships between men in the ancient world. So, as I say, I'll be considering some of the potential issues of looking to the past to find positive examples for LGBT plus activism and education today, and that's how I want to sort of end the presentation. So Edward Perry Warren, or Ned, as he was known to his friends and family, was first born in Massachusetts in 1860, and you can see a sort of grainy image there. It's not a great quality, but this is an image of the Warren family. He was born the son of a wealthy Bostonian who had made his money in paper mills. I won't say too much about Warren's childhood, but just to say that we know from Warren's autobiography that he was interested in classical antiquities from a very young age, and his mother encouraged him in this. Warren, first of all, went to Harvard University, and in his autobiography, he tells us about frustrations of not being able to make relationships and bonding between with fellow male students. So he did actually move to Oxford in 1883. He moved to New College, Oxford University. And Warren here was actually pleased. He tells us in his autobiography, he was pleased to find more sympathies for male bonding at Oxford, whether these were kind of erotic or not. But he was pleased to find more homosocial, as historians of sexuality like to call it, relationships between the boys at Oxford. And this was inspired in particular at Oxford by the pupils' reading of ancient Greek texts such as Plato's Symposium. And in Plato's Symposium, we hear about the love of boys, which is described as heavenly or Uranian love, whereas the love of women is described as common or pandemic love. And if you've read Morris by Ian Forster, you'll recognise this trope, which is this idea of men realising their sexuality through reading the Symposium at Oxford. It's a kind of, we find this in several autobiographies of men around this time, and this is what Ian Forster was drawing upon when he wrote Morris. So in the 19th and early 20th century world of Christian intolerance against male same-sex desire, this positive image that they found in the Symposium, that these men found in Symposium from Greece, from the very cradle of civilization itself, was very welcome, to a lot of these people. And the term Uranian in particular became really important for men like Warren to describe their attraction for younger men. So Warren wrote a 3-volume massive tome called A Defense of Uranian Love, and you can see the most recent or the modern publication of it there. Simmons, I should say, has also been called a Uranian poet. He's also put in with the sort of historical understanding of this group of Uranians at this time. In some ways, though, people are sort of arguing now that Simmons had an issue with the age difference aspects of the ancient Greek relationship, and in some ways was actually in favour of relationships between adult men of the same age. But I won't go into that today. But in ancient Greece, these age-different relationships between older and younger men were expected. The age of the younger partner, I should say, is really hotly debated among scholars. So some people, it ranges from sort of 12 up to 18, 19, maybe even older. So there's a lot of debate about that. And I should say that Warren never specifies how the age, certainly the minimum age of the sort of boys that were involved in these ideal relationships that he describes. So back to Oxford, where he's discovering these Greek texts. So these boys at Oxford they're reading the symposium, and scholars such as Daniel Orrells have pointed out that the kind of intimate study which took place between the male dons and their male students like Warren when they're reading these texts mimicked the kinds of ancient mentor-pupil erotic relationships between an older, wiser man and a younger man that they were actually discovering and reading about in these texts. So this deepened the impact of these readings. And Warren in particular talks about how he saw Oxford as the place in all the world where this kind of erotic mentorship between men was most likely to be able to be revived. It was the place where it could lead to the sort of full revival of this Greek style setup. If it could happen anywhere in the world. And later on in Warren's life, this spurned one of the weirder, odder events in his biography. So in Warren's will, we find that he left funds to Oxford for the restoration of the praelectorship in Greek. So it's just a type of lecturer in Greek at Corpus Christi College. And Warren specifies in his will that this position should only be filled by a bachelor so that they can, quote, connect with the young men and devote their time fully to the care of the students. But when the governing body at Oxford refused, they said, you know, we can't just only employ bachelors. Warren made this extraordinary stipulation in his will that he said, in the event of employing a married man whose family home was outside of the college where the students live, an underground passage or tunnel must be created in order that he be constantly accessible to the young men day or night. So this is one of Warren's weirder ideas. And of course the tunnel was never built, but the position was eventually created in the 1950s, and it still actually continues to this day. One of our ex-lecturers at Exeter is currently in the position. So while still an undergraduate at Oxford in the 1880s, sort of going back in time a little bit, Warren had planned to build, he had a lot of money, by the way, he was from a very wealthy family, he'd planned to build and fund a postgraduate college for the study of Greek art at Oxford. And so this is part of this development of him. We can see that he saw ancient antiquities as really crucial to encouraging this modern revival of Uranianism in the modern world. However, again, Oxford refused this offer, so he didn't get to create his College of Greek Art. So just thinking about Warren and his relationship with objects from a young age. So Warren followed in a Victorian tradition which really closely linked homoeroticism with classical Greek sculpture and particularly the male nude. So this was particularly linked with the cult of aestheticism and writers like Walter Pater in the 19th century. And Pater was himself drawing on ideas from 18th century German art historian Johann Winckelmann. And in Warren's autobiography, we see he describes these kind of erotic descriptions of statuary, even from a young boy. He talks about this school friend who he compares to a statue of Antinous, who is the Roman Emperor Hadrian's lover, sculpted representations of Antinous are really firmly associated with Victorian homoeroticism. But crucially, Warren also drew on Winckelmann's ideas about this idea that statuary was linked to male same-sex desire in antiquity itself. So in the defence of Uranian love, for example, Warren talks about this, he says, it was no softened Eronymus, which is beloved, by the way, which is the younger partner in this pederastic relationship, that the Greek lover was occupied, constantly associated in field, palaestra, with the best youth of the day, seeing their firm outlines and hard muscles immortalized in sculpture, he was occupied with the contemplation of the power and glory of the masculine. So the palaestra is the place where the ancient Greeks wrestled naked, and where the Eromenos, so the younger partner in this relationship, the beloved, could hone his athletic, disciplined, naked body. And this is also the place where the Erastes, the lover, could come and admire him, come and admire his naked body. And so Warren really firmly believes that the modern lover, the modern lover of boys, could also build his appreciation of these kind of bodies by looking at the very same objects, the very same statues from the ancient world that had been brought down to him from antiquity. And the sort of the insistence that we see there on the no softened, this idea of the sort of manliness, the virile nature of ancient pederasty, was inspired by Simmons largely. So Simmons wrote the first English language study of ancient pederasty in 1883, and in this Simmons, in general, draws upon ancient Greece to disprove an association between effeminacy and male same-sex desire. So he says later, he says in his diaries, I am more masculine than many men I know who adore women. Yeah. And these ideas of Simmons informed Simmons' own collaborations with the sexologist Henry Havelock Ellis and their work on sexual inversion, as it was called then, you can see a copy of it there. So going back to Warren, sorry, in 1890, Warren, he'd left university and he'd kind of been a bit stumped in his attempts to make some kind of headway at Oxford in his realizing his vision. So in 1890, he tried to create his own sanctuary of all-male, sort of comradely seclusion, in which he could encourage this Greek living and male bonding. And in this place, statuary and classical antiquities were really important. So he began to rent Lewis House, which is still there in Lewis in Sussex, an 18th century townhouse with, you can see, garden stables and a paddock. Again, as I've said before, he was incredibly wealthy, and he lived here with his lover, John Marshall, who's a Liverpudlian, who he met at Oxford, and who became his life partner and also collecting partner. They called each other Puppy, and maybe that might be because of their shared interest in dogs that you can see there. But what's really striking about this kind of image of Warren and Marshall is how similar they are and how similar they present themselves. And that's, you know, it's really striking because Warren's idealized relationships are all about these age differences, yeah, between the older and the younger man. So it's all about the sort of difference, the asymmetry, inequality, whereas, as you can see, his most significant real-life relationship was with a man of about the same age. So, yeah, it's really interesting to think about these kind of complex histories of sort of how people create idealized relationships and how people actually live their lives. Warren talks about wanting to create a particularly masculine alternative to domesticity in Warren House. So this is what he's trying to do. And in particular, he has a ban on women in the house, for example, except for staff members, I should say. So his housekeeper was a woman. Warren saw this. He thought there was a dangerous softening influence of having women around, and this was an enemy to male bonding. And I should, you know, I should point out that Warren's Uranianism was really quite misogynistic, even compared to some other sort of similar ideas at the time. So there were other sexual reformers, such as Edward Carpenter, who were promoting, who were interested in same-sex desire, but they were also promoting women's rights and female same-sex desire. But Warren, as I say, was particularly misogynistic in his ideas about male bonding. So Lewis House was described as a monkish establishment, and despite the fact that Warren had lots of money, and he did, there was a lot of food there, and it was kind of grand inside, but actually he tried to encourage things like what he called hardiness, and he did this by a lack of electricity in the house and also a lack of sort of comfortable seats, so everyone had to sit on benches. And this sort of comradeship idea was bred in the house by sharing personal possessions like soap and also bathing together, so people comment on this later. It's quite fun. I'm not sure everyone really enjoyed that. And the sort of physical aspects, the physical discipline, was encouraged by getting the guests to use the horses and also to swim in the river and swim in the local swimming pool naked, which apparently the Lewis local residents did not appreciate. And in particular, Warren was keen on the swimming because he says that swimming, quote, afforded the one opportunity under modern conditions for the display and exercise of naked human body and something like the atmosphere of the palaestra, so the naked wrestling ground that we saw earlier. So that's why he's so keen on the men swimming together. It's interesting, I think, because Simmons, again, getting him in here a bit, who also went to Oxford in the 19th century, he expresses this concern about the transition of male students from Oxford into the real world. So he talks about this idea that, you know, they've been at Oxford where, you know, they can read the Symposium and they're in some way sort of protected in their homoerotic explorations. They can do this sort of safely, whereas in the real world there's obviously really real dangers of, you know, in trying to pursue relationships with other men. And in a lot of ways, I think Warren uses his enormous wealth in order to create a solace in Lewis House, in order to protect himself and his contemporaries from this hostile world. The place is really important for him and Marshall to cement and develop their relationship. So they started collecting together at this time. They became collecting partners. And hundreds of their antiquities would come through the house, would pass through. And this shared collecting adventure, but also the display of the material in the house, scholars have identified as really important for their bond and the sort of construction of this alternative domesticity, this domestic setup that they were creating. And this photo from 1893 is really lovely. It's a set of photos of them in the garden of Lewis House, and you can see there Warren's cradling a male nude that they've brought together. And this also is an indication of the kinds of tactile, sort of eroticized tactile engagement that they shared together. So Warren and Marshall, for example, they invented this thing, a way of distinguishing sculptures by the shape of what they called the pelvic line. So the pubic region basically was their way of, a particular way of categorizing and distinguishing particular sculptures. And in 1893, when Marshall was away, as he was a lot, collecting, he wrote back to Warren and says, "Those beastly swellings will be the only thing to rescue me from blank despair, for I feel so lonely here." So he's thinking about the groin regions of these statues, but he's really thinking about Warren. So, who was at what Lewis House? Well, regular visitors and residents, many of them had sort of homoerotic interests, including some of the men from Oscar Wilde's circle, who came to Lewis as a kind of safe haven after Oscar Wilde was arrested in 1895, and that includes Wilde's ex-lover Robbie Ross, who you can see there. Roger Fry from the art world was also linked to Lewis House. He was there a lot, and he was part of the Bloomsbury groups. So that kind of links to another really important group in LGBT history. Although, of course, we know that, you know, Vanessa Bell and Virginia Woolf, who are members of the Bloomsbury group, would not have been welcome in Lewis House. And the French sculptor Auguste Rodin also came to visit. And he came to study Warren's antiquities, and Warren actually commissioned a copy of Rodin's The Kiss himself, and he paid £1,000 for it, so a lot of money at that time. And Warren, in the letters between Rodin and Warren, Warren says, "Being a pagan and a lover of antiquities, he insists that the genitals of the man must be complete." So in the original Rodin piece of The Kiss, the man's genitals were kind of subtly hidden away, and this is a kind of modern convention, whereas what Warren's saying is, according to the classical Greek tradition, I want them, you know, fully, obviously, in sight. And when Rodin had visited Warren, the Kiss was created, and it's now at the Tate Britain, so you can see it there. After Rodin had visited Warren in 1911, he wrote back to Warren and says, "The admiration that I felt for your way of living, for your very enlightenment taste for works of art, have all increasingly aroused in me the desire to live in the Greek manner of thinking." So you can really see that the kind of really clear example of some of the successes of Warren's intentions at Lewis. And Lewis House was given the nickname the Lewis School of Archaeology because of this amount of material that was coming through it. And this name was actually given to him by a young John Davidson Beasley. The image is horrible there, I know it's bad quality, but I really like the image. So if you know anything about classical archaeology, you will have heard of Beasley. He was about in his 20s when he met Warren, but later became a very eminent archaeologist and art historian. And he was, quote, this is a Bernard Ashmole, who's another historian, later described how Beasley, at Lewis House, Beasley was able to study at leisure a whole range of newly found and acquired vases, sculptures and gems, and enjoy the intellectual stimulus of these two fine scholars and lovers of antiquity. So my research suggests that Warren and Marshall were some of the first people to start cataloguing scenes of sexual antiquities, scenes of sexual activity between men and boys on Greek pots, and we'll talk a bit more about this later. And to share, and they shared this research with Beasley, and this would eventually culminate in Beasley's famous groundbreaking catalogue that you can see here of this type of scene. Again, we'll talk a bit more in a minute about that. Beasley also saw the Warren Cup while it was at Lewis. We know that because he later made a copy of it, which is now in the Ashmolean Museum. And I just think it's interesting that Warren's mentorship of these young men, so not just Beasley, other art historians as well, he paid for them. He, for example, paid for Beasley to go to America to do some research there on classical antiquities. So these kind of mentorships of young men that Warren took part in not only kind of acted out aspects of Greek pederasty, but actually they enabled these young men to engage with antiquities, which is what he saw as the key to encouraging the Iranian ideal in the modern day. So the kind of great, what was known to their friends as the great collecting years of Warren and Marshall was 1892 to 1902. And they became buyers and donors for museums across Europe and America. And they put together a personal collection as well, which they then bequeathed to a number of institutions. And particularly, they were responsible for creating the classical collections at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts and also the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Met, at New York. Beasley would later praise Marshall particularly as being one of the foremost archaeologists of his day, which is really interesting because you don't really hear about him. But it's because, and as Beasley regretted, he spent all of this, he used his knowledge for collecting rather than for publishing works about these materials that he was engaging with. Combined with Warren's financial resources, so combining Marshall's knowledge and skills with Warren's really formidable financial resources and his shrewd collecting skills, we should say, they became this really amazing team of collectors, and they would eventually corner the market in antiquities, such to the extent that the director of Greece and Rome at the British Museum complained, quote, there is nothing to be got nowadays since Warren and Marshall are always on the spot first. So they were really doing well. Amongst their many, many acquisitions, most notably for my interest, and probably why you're here today, are nearly 200 objects featuring sexual imagery. And a good proportion of these are Greek pots showing sexual activities between older and younger men. And as I've hinted at, what's really interesting from their notebooks, and you can see one of the sketches from their notebooks up there, is that Warren and Marshall seem to have been some of the first scholars to identify, as I've said, this a reoccurring motif on Greek vases as a sexual scene between men. So the scene, which you can see a few examples of here, it's a motif in which an older man reaches down to the genitals of a younger man while reaching up to the younger man's chin. And Warren and Marshall were amongst the first to unlock this somewhat coded image. It's not really obvious that a sexual act is taking place, but that's what scholars agree is actually happening. And 20 years after Warren's death, as I've said, Beasley, their protege, would produce his catalogue of male courtship scenes in which he included this as one of the key examples. And he called this motif the up and down gesture, so that's how we know it. And what seems really obvious to me, but which hasn't been acknowledged, really, is that Beasley's scholarship started, his interest in this scene and his knowledge about it started with Warren and Marshall and his time at Lewis House. So scholars are increasingly aware that without Warren, we would know much less than we do about homosexuality in classical art. That's a quote. And the material that Warren collected does form a really significant part of the canon of evidence that we now use for sexuality studies. But it hasn't really been, Warren and Marshall haven't really been credited for the intellectual impact that they had on our current understanding of this material through this direct influence on Beazley in particular. Another debate in modern scholarship about these Greek vases that Warren contributed to was this idea that, which became very important throughout the 20th century, that vases show more real-life depictions of what happened in ancient Athens between men and boys than we find, for example, in some literature. And Warren was particularly interested in this because he thought that the vases contradicted what Plato said in the Symposium. So as I've said, Plato's Symposium, very influential ancient work on love between men. And in the Symposium, arguably, this is very much debated, but arguably, Plato suggests that relationships between men and boys should focus on the spiritual and the philosophical development of the younger man and deny sexual activity altogether. Whereas Warren insisted that what he called the Uranian Eros was, quote, consonant in his spiritual flights with his earthly base. So some spiritual stuff, some physical stuff was really important in this relationship. And Warren, interestingly, describes Plato as a Puritan who didn't represent the ideas of the Greeks in general, is what he says. So when he's calling Plato a Puritan, he's obviously challenging in some way his own, Warren's own Puritanism upbringing in Boston. But he's also, interestingly, I think, hitting out at fellow Uranians, so fellow men who look to ancient Greece for models of relationships with men, particularly in the 19th century and the early 20th century, who had promoted this kind of platonic spirituality and celibacy in order to defend love between men. So for hundreds of years, there'd been an association particularly with sodomy and with what the scholar Linda Dowling calls the blind urgencies of merely animal sexuality with love between men. And most famously, Oscar Wilde, in his ultimately unsuccessful 1895 defence speech in court, had described the love that dare not speak its name, such as Plato made the very basis of his philosophy, that is pure as it is perfect. And that the word pure has been debated by scholars exactly what Wilde meant there. But Warren certainly took it to mean celibacy there, that Wilde was suggesting that the relationship between older and younger men was celibate. Simmons had also challenged this idea of purity in ancient pederasty, and he had argued that there were really important physical aspects to this ancient relationship. And he said, quote, though it was not free from sensuality, it did not degenerate into mere licentiousness. And Warren agreed with this. He agreed that ancient and modern pederasty should be balanced between the physical and the spiritual. But he made it really clear that there could be no compromise on sexual fulfillment. And he was really angered by people that did it, that denied it. But thankfully for Warren, he was never actually obliged to defend these views in the face of a jury. So we don't know what he would have said if he had to. These ideas in particular, I should say, as I said, were really influential throughout the 20th century. And in particular, they, by sort of being passed through classical scholarship, they became influential on the formidable philosopher Michel Foucault, who essentially rewrote the history of sexuality in the late 1970s and 1980s. And Foucault says that vases are infinitely more explicit than literature and demonstrate that the Greeks showed more than they told. So basically, you know, we can see more of what actually happened than what they said happened in their literature. And just a final thought about these vases, an observation that Warren and Marshall made, which is still really crucial to our understanding of these vases and ancient sexuality today, is this idea that this iconography, so these images of men having sex with men on vases, actually pretty much disappeared after the early classical period. And the date that scholars now give for that is 475 BC. It's kind of, scholars still debate why that happened, But Warren's suggestion was that it was because of an increase in the presence of women in daily life at Athens in the later classical period. So this idea that there's an increase in the presence of women, he didn't make that up. That was already an established idea at Warren's time. But Warren believed that this feminization in Athenian society caused the diminishment of these kind of healthy, masculine sexual relationships between men and boys. So while in the earlier period, we find this kind of celebration in Greece of kind of sweaty, naked male athletes in the sort of in their poetry and in their statuary, for example, in the later 4th century BC, this feminized culture, according to Warren, resulted in in Plato's call for rejecting physical relationships between men altogether. So for Warren, female emancipation was clearly the enemy of Uranianism. That's what he concluded. And this had devastating implications for modern life for Warren. And in particular, he was upset by the entry of women, which happened around the end of the 19th century, into his precious Oxford University. So Warren believed that the increasing, what he called female domination of Western culture in the early 20th century, went far beyond what the Greeks had experienced and had this, and he was particularly upset that it was going to destroy what he saw as the last old world enclave where pederastic bonding could be still revived at Oxford. So just moving on to the Roman objects and the famous Warren Cup. So not only was Warren one of the first people to, I suggest, recognise the extent of sexual activity on Greek vases, he also was one of the first people to collect the extremely rare, we should say, scenes of male-male sex on Roman objects. So Warren collected 7 pieces of this type of object, and that is the largest collection that's ever been put together. And most of them are now at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. So you can see how rare they are. And of course, the most striking image object of this collection is the Warren Cup. It's a silver cup thought to be found near Jerusalem around AD 5 to 15, so or sort of around the time of Jesus. And it shows, it was probably made in Italy though, I should say, and it shows graphic scenes, as you can see, of anal sex between older and younger men, which are really kind of delicately hammered out from the inside of the cup. So it's an incredibly expensive piece in its original ancient context. And Warren apparently paid £2,000 for it, which was a huge amount of money at that time. In around 1911, he bought it. And there have been questions of authenticity over the cup and also some of the other objects that Warren collected, some of these that you can see here. And these questions are partly fueled by the rarity of these objects, but also because of the apparent kind of acute compatibility with Warren's erotic interest. So this kind of very physical depiction of relationships between an older and a younger man that you can see on the cup. Most recently, technical surveys in the last couple of years of the corrosion of the silver, which is just way beyond my knowledge, have convinced one particular prominent skeptic that it is genuine. And I think that Warren, anyway, definitely believed that it was genuine. He was really concerned to find with buying fakes, we know. And from his notes, I think it's really quite clear from the way that he treats the cup that he did genuinely believe it was an ancient object. In Warren and Marshall's notebooks, when they are looking at Greek vases, they're really interested in finding Greek vases that show really unambiguous examples of sexual activity between men, because it's not always that obvious, as I showed you there. It's not quite clear. Sometimes it looks like they're just sort of pointing at the genitals, or like, as Warren says, they might just be having a conversation because they're kind of hands up and down. And so when Warren and Marshall find a scene that's really obviously there's something sexual going on there, they call it very much to the point. That's their kind of code for finding evidence of physical pederasty. And so I think, the Warren Cup is quite obviously very much to the point in that sense, more so than the Greek vases. And so we shouldn't be surprised to find that Warren referred to it as his Holy Grail. Of course, I should just say quickly, the Warren Cup is Roman and not Greek, obviously, so it doesn't fit with Warren's idealised kind of relationships there, because it's not about Greece. But many scholars now suggest that it does borrow from the aesthetics of classical Greek pederasty. So in Rome, we think it wasn't this kind of relationship wasn't acceptable, i.e. relationships between freeborn adult men and younger men, freeborn younger men. So basically Romans could have sex with their slaves, their male slaves if they wanted to, but they weren't allowed to have sex with younger freeborn men, citizen men. And the Warren Cup scholars suggest draws, there is a big debate about this, but some scholars suggest it draws from the iconography of a Greek symposium. So again, this all-male drinking party that Plato describes, which is very much associated with homoeroticism in the ancient world, and I won't go into sort of details there, but I suggest Warren saw the cup in this way, that it was drawing on earlier tradition of Greek pederasty. Unfortunately, we don't have Warren's direct notes on the Warren Cup. I have looked a lot in the archives, but I haven't been able to find them. But crucially for Warren, I think these images present, on the Warren Cup, they present a very different version of the symposium to that which was presented in, that he found in Plato's symposium. So if this is a symposium, this is a very sexualized symposium. This isn't about chastity. It's not ending in a denial of sexual relationships. And finally, the Warren Cup manages to rescue these sexual relationships with boys also from the notion of that sort of simply bestial lust that we talked about earlier. So as I say, if this is a symposium, the younger man would have, before the sexual act or maybe afterwards, he would have also been developing his ethical, philosophical, manly competence by time spent with his older lover. Art historians such as John Clark have argued that these Roman images managed to show sodomy, this physical act which had haunted ideas about same-sex love for centuries, in a very elevated and romantic way. So I suggest for Warren, the cup was a holy grail because it went beyond the Greek material by presenting a really sexualized but also very elevated vision of Greek Uranianism. So it offered, as I say, an alternative to these two competing models for same-sex relationships at the turn of the 20th century when Warren was collecting the cup between, on one hand, immoral lust, and on the other side, platonic chastity. It provides a middle way. So just to finish up about Warren, Warren's life purpose, as I think I've tried to suggest, was the promotion of Greece in particular and classical art in order to correct what he saw as the failings of modern Western Christian culture, particularly the demonization of homosexual love and the sanctification of heterosexual married love, which he thought was exacerbated by the rise of sexual equality. And he thought this was at its worst in his hometown of Boston. So on a vacation to Boston, for example, Warren wrote back to Marshall, he said, "Here with cold winds and snow, the traditions of Puritanism and the absence of aesthetic sympathy, all Greece is frozen out. Therefore," he says, "it was my hate of Boston that made me work for Boston." So he wants to do something to improve this. And in bringing this classical art to the US, Warren wanted to fill, quote, "the terrible gap that exists on this continent, the absence of which delights the eye and rests the soul." And he described his creation of the classical department at the Boston Museum as truly a paederastic evangel. It must be counted a result of love. So he sent almost his entire erotic collection to Boston. And in a lot of ways, these were meant to be an antidote to this Puritanism that he found in Boston and this repressive attitude to sexuality. So he explained this kind of really quite tactfully to the museum. So he says, it's a little bit coded, but it's interesting. He says, "Art springs directly from life of man, and I've always had my doubts whether it was consistent with moral aspirations which we of New England inherit. All systems of morals which ignore the possible richness of man's life are fragile and indeed lead to their contraries. Unhealthy Puritanism leads to immorality. To me, it is a pleasure to store up objects in the museum which may lead to a reconsideration of very intricate problems now regarded as settled." So as I say, it's a bit coded, but basically he's saying he's trying to shake up Puritanism by bringing this material to the museum. And his attempt, excuse me, to show Boston a healthy approach to sex and sexuality and the body can perhaps explain the quite surprising inclusion of nearly 30 images of men and women having sex that Warren donated to the Boston Museum, which, you know, given his misogyny and his preference idealization of male relationships, we might be surprised to find these kind of objects that he gave to the museum, including the Boston Mirror there, which is quite famous, really intricately made image of men and women having sex. As I say, I think that these kind of explicit images, although they didn't show the sort of relationships that he wanted to promote, they were all just meant to shake up this unhealthy Puritanism that he talks about. So he was prepared even to promote the kind of sexual experience that he detested in a way, in order to clear the way for more transgressive and radical images that he wanted to bring to Boston, such as the Greek vases showing sexual activity between men, and he hoped this would lead to the improvement of public attitudes towards sex between men. It's always been assumed that the Warren Cup was always meant to just be in Warren's possession, and that he never tried to get rid of it because of the nature of its imagery. But actually, in a letter in the archives, there's a letter from Warren to the Boston Museum in 1921, at the end of Warren's life. He actually did offer them the Warren Cup, and they did actually accept it, interestingly. But for some reason, I'm not sure why, and I haven't been able to find out, the transactions broke down and it never went there. So I suggest, although at Lewis House, Warren and his friends had really enjoyed this powerful imagery, when it came to the end of his life in 1921, Warren obviously wanted America to inherit this jewel of his pederastic collection because he thought America had the most use for it. And after Warren's death, the cup stayed in private hands throughout the 20th century. And in 1999, the British Museum actually decided to purchase the cup. So you may have seen it there for $1.8 million, I think still the most that they've ever spent on a single object. And this act is often viewed as a major watershed in UK and international museums' attitudes to dealing with the topic of sexuality, and particularly LGBT history. And just as it was for Warren in the 21st century, the Warren Cup has gone on to be really important for many people as part of a much-needed celebration of non-heterosexual identities in the past by showing that such identities and relationships have had a long and established heritage. And just in this last part, I just want to consider some of this legacy. So as well as researching the histories of people like Warren, who collected classical material, I also work on a public engagement project at Exeter, in collaboration with museums and schools, in which we use objects from the past, inspired by people like Warren, in sex education activities and sexual health activities with young people. And I know that OutStories are also doing similar work, and they've produced some excellent resources for schools to explore sexual and gender diversity using historical figures local to Bristol, such as Simmons himself. So you should check those out if you're interested. And we, and I know OutStories as well, have found that historical material, just as it did for Warren, has this amazing capacity to get people thinking and talking in new ways and in thinking more critically about sex and gender and relationships today. And like many people around the UK, we as a project are trying to include LGBT plus experiences in our resources that we're developing. And this is particularly urgent because there's the new legislation that's coming in around compulsory sex education in the UK. So what about the Warren Cup? So in the World in 100 Objects series at the British Museum, which you may have heard, TV historian Bettany Hughes talks about how the Warren Cup is going to be this routine that she uses to introduce gay relationships to her young daughters. So she's going to show them the cup and talk about homosexuality with them. And I have this sort of reservation about using the Warren Cup in particular in schools or in LGBT plus education. And it's sort of an example of some of the issues that we come across when we want to use the past in order to think about today. So first of all, the historian in me wants to point out that neither the Romans nor Warren would have identified the Warren Cup as a gay object in the way that we understand it today. So as I'm sure you're aware, words like gay, homosexuality are modern terms. And many historians of sexuality argue that these meanings and behind the terms are also not transferable onto the ancient world, for example. But if we refuse to see any continuity between the Warren Cup and the modern gay experience, you know, how do we avoid what historian Richter Norton has called, how he's put it, obscuring the rich history of people who have been attracted to their own gender. But in an even more pressing concern, I think, might be that looking to this ancient convention of adult men having sex with teenage or even younger boys, which we find on the cup, and which Warren obviously idealised, we run the risk of perpetuating this modern conflation, which still exists between being gay or LGBT and pederasty or even paedophilia, I'm afraid. So this kind of really bothers me, and I haven't resolved it yet. But I did show the Warren Cup in a focus group once to some university students, so they were a bit older, and I talked about these reservations that I had about using the cup to discuss LGBT plus experiences today, and I asked for responses, and interestingly a young black woman who identified as a lesbian, she said to me that in spite of these concerns she would really like to see the Warren Cup discussed in schools and discussed in sex and relationships education with her peers. So I found that really interesting, because we might not think that there's very much about this image that represents her experience, but she said she wanted, it was just seeing something other than purely heterosexual relationships in sex education and in schools that was really important to her. And clearly there's so much more that we can do to represent her particular experience and perspective in classrooms and museums. But yeah, is there something that, despite the differences and the difficulties about age differences, could the Warren Cup be useful in this context? I want to ask questions about kind of how much do we need to find a mirror of ourselves in the past for the past to be inspiring or even just thought-provoking for us. And it's undeniable that the classical world and images like the Warren Cup have provided an incredible source for valuing relationships outside of the heterosexual norm from before Warren's time and through to today. And the British Museum actually has just started to deliver their own sex education lessons using their objects, and they've actually included the Warren Cup in their programme. So I'm really looking forward to learning more about how that has gone. Okay, I think that's the end. Thank you.